In this hour of Focus 580, we will return to a subject we've talked about before, and that is genetically modified food and genetically modified crops that end up producing foods. Fairly recently on the show, we spoke with Bruce Chassie. He's the Associate Executive Director of the U of I Campus Biotechnology Center. And as we try to do on various issues, we try to bring you different perspectives on these issues. And so we'll be doing another program this morning with someone who raises questions about this technology, has been critical about this technology. And our guest is Craig Holdridge. He's director of the Nature Institute, which is located in Ghent, New York. He was very much involved, in fact, in founding the Institute in 1998. This is an organization that is interested in changing the way people think about and also affect nature. He is a biologist and educator. He's the author of Genetics and the Manipulation of Life, The Forgotten Factor of Context, published by Lindisfarne Press in 1996. He has written articles on cloning and genetic engineering for many American and European journals. He's also lectured a good deal on biotechnology here in this country and in Europe. He is primarily responsible for the Nature Institute's biology programs. Since 1980, he has also been a high school biology teacher and has taught at the Hawthorne Valley School in rural Ghent in New York since 1992. He teaches in all areas of biology, including field botany and ecology. He's been involved in teacher training also for a number of years. He presently teaches summer courses at New England Waldorf High School Teacher Training in Wilton, New Hampshire. And he is joining us this morning by telephone. If you're interested, by the way, in finding out more about the Nature Institute, they do have a website. They have some papers there, some things, in fact, that Craig Holdridge has written. He also contributed recently to an issue of the Sierra Club magazine that looked at this technology. So that's another place that you can go to read some of his writing. And as we talk this morning, you can call in. Questions and comments are certainly welcome. All you have to do to join the conversation is pick up your telephone and dial the number. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, so if it would be long-distance call for you, you're listening around Illinois, Indiana, any place that signal will travel, that number is 800-222-9455. So 333-WILL and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Mr. Holdridge, hello.
Yes. Good morning.
Thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Do you want to, again, say maybe a little bit more about the Nature Institute and what it's all about?
Yeah, well, the Nature Institute, which you mentioned, it's a young organization. We just started it up 3 years ago out of the many concerns about developments in technology and in biological sciences. What we try to do is, on the one hand, to put biotechnology in regard to agriculture, but also issues regarding human, like the Human Genome Project and genetic engineering with human beings, that we try to put those developments into a larger biological and ecological context, because often they're looked at from such a narrow perspective. And it's our conviction that in order to really understand the impact of these technologies and then also to be able to work with them fruitfully or not work with them if they are too hazardous, that one really needs to look at them in a large context. And so that's the one aspect of our work, and then that's complemented by the other aspect, which goes into the which basically studies the integrity or the interconnectedness of all the processes in any given living organism. Each organism is a whole, an animal or a plant, and each function that goes on in an organism is related to every other function, and it's extremely complex, but we try to get some kind of a picture of this complexity also in relation to the environment so that we have at least an adequate beginning understanding of what we're dealing with when we're talking about a living creature, and that we don't go from reduced, sometimes very simple mechanistic models of things and that we think those are the reality instead of the actual complexity of the thing itself. Mm.
Just to stay with this idea of, for a moment, of how it is that whatever public debate there is about this technology, how that goes on. Think back to the last program. I guess this was just last week. We were talking about this with someone here from the university. And a caller called in and made the observation that the mainstream, she says, mainstream media are not giving us the straight story about this technology, and particularly the potential health impacts of genetically modified crops, and then what happens when they get in food products, and then what happens when they get in us. And the guest responded with his perception that he said, well, in fact, if you take a look at the kind of news coverage that's been devoted in mainstream media to genetically modified food, that it's actually been very negative, that it's been a lot of stories about how about the downsides of these things and is it killing butterflies and is it going to be bad for us? And I wonder, thinking about just in fact the way that most media, mainstream media, print and broadcast has written about this issue, what you think about that, about what the discussion has been like, and indeed whether in that what debate there is, we're focusing on the wrong questions.
Yeah. I mean, if one compares the situation now to how it was a few years back, at least one can say there is more media coverage so that this has even become a theme. I mean, part of the problem, as I see it, is that people are just not aware that there is a problem, that there is a question, that still one can read of polls where people, you know, don't really have any idea what it means to say genetically engineered food, or that it exists, or that, you know, 70% of the products that are out there that contain, you know, corn and soybeans, that they come from genetically engineered organisms, and that so that there is a very broad ignorance, which does speak for the fact that something's not getting out there. That's the one side. On the other hand, I can't say, you know, I read the New York Times personally, and there are articles that are critical to genetic engineering. There are articles that are, you know, very positive. So that I think there are, you know, both sides come out, and I wouldn't say that nothing is coming out in the media. It's just that I don't think there is a great enough awareness altogether of the questions that we're really confronted with, so that that in that sense it's not enough.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it certainly is true, just to underscore what you said, that people now are consuming foods that have GM components and don't know that.
Right. And of course, and that I see as one of the major problems, that we're in a society that we're basically the consumer has to take what he or she gets, and that we don't really have our rights are not being recognized to say, well, I would like to be able to choose, and that we aren't even given that right. You know, to go into a store and to know that something has been produced in a particular manner. You can go into the refrigeration part of a supermarket and tell whether you're getting orange juice that's made that's fresh or that's pasteurized and fresh, or that's come from concentrate. Right, that always is on the label. But you can't go in to your crackers part of the supermarket and find whether you're eating crackers that have soy in them that come from genetically engineered soybeans. So that we have a real problem there. I see it as a consumer now, and not so much now looking at it from a scientific point of view, but as a consumer, that there is a lot that needs to be done in the way of having product information, that people have a certain right to know where their food comes from, even though that's scientists will argue against that, and regulatory agencies will say, well, they don't have a right, but I maintain we do.
Mm-hmm. Well, it may indeed be a separate question, maybe something for another show, but it is something that has been discussed, has been debated, and I wonder whether you think whether eventually, and it may indeed be something that there would have to be enough public demand for it before it would happen, but that eventually that kind of labeling will be on products, and then I guess we can see what people think about it.
Yeah, I mean, I would hope that would be the case. That I'm optimistic. You know, many of the things that have happened have kind of been forced on us from Europe. You know, that the European consumer is more critical than the American consumer altogether, is in my perception, and that, you know, because of the uproar in Europe, that kind of the backwash came then to us, more from a business perspective of exports, you know, and then not having the possibility to export things if they were genetically engineered. That's the one pathway that might lead to some change, and the other is more awareness on the part of the consumer and then more activism in the sense of making our government aware of what we want.
Our guest this morning in this part of Focus 580, Craig Holdridge. He is the director of the Nature Institute, a relatively young organization, as he says, in Ghent, New York, interested in changing the way that people think about and perceive and affect nature. They do have a website with information on the organization that you can look for. It's at it's natureinstitute.org.
That's right.
Is that right? Okay. So it's relatively simple to be able to find. And there are various information there, papers, some of them that Mr. Holdridge has written. So if you have internet access, you can get it some information about the organization. And, of course, your questions are welcome, 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Something that I think probably we always talk about every time we discuss this topic, and, again, it's one of those things that depending on who you ask, you're going to get a very different answer. And that is this. Human beings have been modifying plants and animals to the extent that their technology would allow them to do it for, as far as we know, for thousands of years, beginning with when they domesticated plants and animals, and then when they realized that by doing selective breeding, you can perhaps end up with individuals, plants and animals that have certain qualities that you want, or maybe you get rid of certain qualities that you don't. And some people would make the argument that the kind of thing that we're doing now with genetic manipulation is really no different.
Right.
That it is just part of a long continuum of people have done the things that they could do. And so, they would say that, well, what's really the difference between a soybean plant that we've produced by doing some genetic manipulation and the soybean plants that we produce just by doing the kind of cross breeding that we could do in the past?
Right. Yeah. Yeah, I have kind of a two-part answer, I guess, to that question or concern. One is that, I mean, through traditional breeding, one can also bring forth animals and plants that are not healthy. I mean, that is true. They're one of my, you know, favorite examples of something that goes a little bit in the direction of being grotesque is Belgian beef, a breed of beef that was bred to be as muscular as possible for beef. And these animals grow so large as fetuses that they cannot be naturally born, and they then are brought into the world through C-section, and exceedingly overly muscular animals. And I would say, you know, that's going beyond a certain boundary because natural birth is no longer possible. And that was done through selection breeding techniques. I don't know the details of it, but I know it was not genetically engineered. So we can create organisms that are unhealthy through traditional breeding. And if genetic engineering is doing the same in that way, then I'd say, good, it's the same. We can have one-sided images of animals and what try to drive them in a one-sided direction through traditional breeding, and we can do the same through genetic engineering, but perhaps in a more effective manner. So in that regard, I would say, yeah, it's more of the same, but it's not the same we want. It's not something we want. Where the difference, though, I think lies is that one has to realize that in selective breeding, one was nonetheless, even if you're looking for a particular trait of stability in a plant or of muscularity in an animal or something like that, nature brings that forth. You don't bring that forth in breeding. And then you watch and you select out of your judgment of the health of the whole organism what which one you want to take then to breed with another animal in order to combine traits, for example. And you're dealing then, any given characteristic that arises in the animal arises within the context of the whole biology, physiology, anatomy of that organism. And when we're doing genetic engineering, we're selecting for one particular trait so that, for example, when first transgenic pigs were created, that one was hoping to get them to grow larger and faster by inserting the gene for growth hormone. It was actually bovine, cow growth hormone, the gene for that, into pigs so that they would get larger and grow faster. And this was done, and the results were different than what one expected. They did not grow larger, but they did grow faster. And then, this was an unexpected side effect, they had less carcass fat. The pork was leaner. So this was actually, you know, great for the pork industry researchers who were doing this work. But very soon they realized this was not going to be a technology that's going to be easy to work with, because the animals had all sorts of other unexpected so-called side effects, so that they were more susceptible to stress, they were lethargic, they suffered from lameness, gastric ulcers, and they had renal disease, their own growth hormone production was suppressed, so that a whole array of unintended consequences were there. By selecting and manipulating one part, the whole organism was changed in a way that one had no idea would be the case. And this is actually very typical for genetic engineering experiments, that you go with the idea of we would like to change this in order to have that, but what you do end up changing through manipulating is the whole organism in one way or another, in unexpected ways. And so sometimes so subtle, or in areas that one doesn't even look, right? You can't test for things you don't look for. So that in doing breeding through genetic engineering, you are taking apart some particular trait that you want and then influencing the whole organism by putting it in there. But this putting it in, and that I need to mention at this point, putting it in an organism is not a delicate and controlled procedure. It's quite hit and miss. Everything that's done in the laboratory is very precise and highly scientific, technological, and then those methods are used to make the gene construct, the different DNA that comes together to go into the organism. And then it's either, for example, little pellets coated with DNA are shot into plant embryos, or DNA is injected into the egg of a cow or of a pig, and then no one knows what happens. What you have to do is to wait and see whether you get results. And you usually get results in about 1% of the cases. Well, you get results in all cases, but the results you want in 1% of the cases. And those are often then, you know, made more complicated by the side effects I was just talking about. So that how the DNA is incorporated into the cell, how the organism deals with that, that is all left up to the organism, so to speak. And one cannot really say what's going to happen. So that it is a much more, I would say, a drastic a way of manipulating the organisms, which one does not do in traditional breeding. And that's not even then speaking about the fact that, you know, here I was giving you an example of bringing something from a cow into a pig. We're not talking then about bringing, you know, flounder genes into strawberries or something, which then going beyond the boundaries of the kingdoms, not only species and families, but of the kingdoms, that, of course, that was never done in traditional breeding.
Mm-hmm. And that's not just something you're making up as a hypothetical.
Which, the flounder
genes. The flounder genes and the,
that,
yeah.
No, right. That was in order, with the idea of having strawberries be resistant to frost.
Yeah. We have several callers, so we'd be happy to get as many people here in the conversation as possible. We have someone on a cell phone, so we're going to get there first on line two. Hello.
Yes, how you guys doing?
Good.
Fine. As a soybean farmer, I'm sure that they, you know, we have a lot of people that are anti-GMO soybeans. And, you know, the point that I want to make is basically this, you know, do you want biotech soybeans, or do you want, you know, me using, you know, herbicides, granted that we use a herbicide on the bio soybeans, but you know, it's a contact and it's not soil applied, and it has no residual in the soil. So the question I put to you is, what do you want? Do you want the herbicide in the soil? Because soybeans are not going to be grown without either herbicide or the Roundup Ready technology. And, you know, we've gone round and round about this for many years. And as a community, you know, I was chastised for using herbicides, and now we're trying to get away from some of this. You know, what's... You tell me what the answer is.
Yeah, I think it's a good point. And Mr. Holdridge, you could, you know, give whatever response you want, because I think farmers sort of feel that they're damned if they do and they're damned if they don't, no matter
right.
what.
You're not going to get around from the herbicide yeah. technology one way or the other. I mean, when you're raising 1,000 acres of soybeans, you know, you're not going to go out there and weed them by hand or do organic. That's not going to happen, and it's never going to happen, you know. So you're going to have to decide which technology you want to go to.
Yeah. Can I just ask the caller just for a second, how much of your this you have soybeans this year, and how much of them are Roundup ready?
75%.
Okay. And are you using less herbicide than before or more herbicide before? Or
sure.
Then?
There was two. When I used conventional soybeans, I went in and I put a soil-applied herbicide to get the grass, okay? And then the next application was a secondary to kill the weeds, you know, the broadleaf weeds that were coming up. And that was usually probably, you know, a combination of contact and soil-applied herbicide. So you had two soil-applied herbicides that are going into the ground, into the soil, into the drinking water, okay? And then I'm going in with Roundup Ready, and I'm spraying just the contact just to kill the weeds. And granted, it goes into the soil a little bit, but supposedly the manufacturer says it's, you know, biodegrades and all that stuff. So, I mean, to me, it's a no-brainer. I'm doing better protecting the ground and the groundwater, and then I'm getting chastised all over the world for trying to do this.
Right. Well, let's get a response from the guest, Mr. Holdridge, because that's, again, it's a point that seems to be raised often when we talk about environmental impact. If we can reduce herbicide use, for example, isn't that a good thing?
Right. Yeah, I mean, I just to say this right at the beginning, I'm always very sympathetic with the problems that the farmers have. I always feel like, you know, farmers are in between a rock and a hard place, and in terms of on the industry on the one side, public opinion on the other, the government on the other side, and what do we do? And all of us, you know, our lives are dependent upon what the farmers do for us. So, I mean, just to put that, you know, at the very beginning. But nonetheless, I think there are questions to be asked about the, you know, the Roundup Ready at the moment. I mean, I can understand your point of view and say, I see what you're saying. And then I've read some studies recently and just, you know, would like to bring that as additional information, that there has been actually in, you know, and over the board, these were studies that were done in various states, including, you know, Iowa and, Midwestern states where most of the Roundup Ready soybeans are grown, that that there has been an increase in the use of herbicide, not a decrease. And one also has to realize that, of course, the plants themselves do, because the plants themselves have become a herbicide, right? They contain the herbicide, that they do actually secrete small amounts of this into the soil. And there have been some soil scientists studying this and seeing that the soil quality has been changed through, not just through the contact and then what comes in, seeps into the soil from above ground, but from below ground also through the roots of the plants, and that from these two directions, there's also been a weakening of the roots in some soybeans, the Roundup Ready soybeans. It's not broad yet, evidently, but there has been some weakening of the bacteria. It's mainly the bacteria that are in the nitrogen-fixing nodules, which are very important for soybean growth, that they have been shown to be affected by the excess amounts of the Roundup that's now in the soil through the spraying and also through the plants.
So you're telling me that there's a residual of Roundup in the soil?
Pardon? I'm not going to say there's in the fall.
Huh?
I can't say how. No, these have been studied. The studies that have been done have not been out have not been field studies. I haven't found any field studies that have gone through from the summer into a next season, you know, from the spring into the next season, or from the fall into the spring. But these are over a period of months. In any case, you have the Roundup binding to the soil particles in a way that makes it then. I was confusing that with another example at the moment. That the Roundup ready soybeans have had weaker root systems, and therefore that's part of the yield drag. I don't know if you've heard about that and whether you've experienced any of that yourself. In various areas, there's been a yield drag of, you know, 5 to 10% with the Roundup Ready, and some Arkansas scientists have thought, well, it's because of the root amounts,
right?
Because of the rooting.
Yield drag is debatable, because when you have environmental conditions, whether if it's going to rain or not rain or soil.
Of course, that's it. I mean, it's most susceptible in drought conditions. That's where it mainly comes about. When if you have a moist environment and you have a good year from that point of view, then there have been shown many less problems.
I want to make one point, and then I'll let you go, because I know you got a lot of people.
Sure.
But the point of it is that the more that is going anti-biotech soybeans, what happens is then when the grain elevators get some kind of sort of like the Starlink thing, when there's a negative impact, okay,
right.
You get a negative impact, the elevators don't have to take these seeds. They don't
right.
have to take this crop. All they have to do is put a sign up at the grain elevator and say, we're not going to raise this. You know, we're not going to take this.
Right.
So as a commercial farmer, then what do you do with a crop? You know, I'm going to take such a huge financial hit that, you know, it's going to question the whole industry. I'm going to come back and question you. I'm going to, you know, question the whole industry, and you know you're gonna do more damage to, you know, agricultural production by, you know, making, you know, either false claims or claims that aren't, you know, valid, you know, and you're not going to hurt the seed companies. You're going to hit the individual producer.
Yeah,
you're
but
take
I mean,
the first hit.
Yeah, but the problem there, as I see it, is that we've had. With the whole biotech industry, they've been running the government regulations. I mean, Dan Glickman, who was the agriculture secretary under Clinton, recently said our regulators were cheerleaders for the biotech industry. I mean, think about that for a moment. Government being the cheerleaders for the biotech industry instead of the regulating. And that lack of regulation, where the biotech industry makes up its own regulations, and then the government's always running behind, and then it comes finally, you know, to the grain elevator. There are no regulations, there are no laws, there's no pathway, so that then the farmer gets hit. I agree with you. I mean, that's a lousy situation, but I don't think that the cause of that is in the critique of biotech. I think it's in the fact that the problems that are definitely present in biotech have not been adequately taken hold of by our regulatory agencies. They just haven't been doing their job. They've been run around, basically, by them.
We're already past our midpoint, and I have several other callers holding, and I appreciate the comments of the last caller. I just want to go on and give some other folks a chance. Let me also just say again, we're talking with Craig Holdridge. He's a director of the Nature Institute in Ghent, New York, and this is part of a continuing effort that we've been making on this show over probably a few years now, to talk about these issues from perspectives of people both who support the technology and people who raise questions about it. And I'm sure we'll continue to do that. This will not be the last show on the subject, I'm sure. Questions, though, are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Next up is someone in Oakwood on line one. Hello.
Hello. You answered most of what I was going to ask, but my genetic knowledge is sort of old, and I was wondering about the when they put these genes in. Now, my understanding of genes was that I wondered how discrete pieces can they get. Now, my understanding of genes is there's often other genes that turn them on and some that turn them off, and I don't know if they're always necessarily close together. Whether, you know, you can be sure you get all of these things, and like you said, I thought that how something acts is also determined by all the other things that are connected with it. Anyway, I wonder how exacting can they pick out these genes? Or just, are most of these things that they're talking when they talk about genes, are they talking about a whole bunch of genes that work together? Or are they really talking about a discrete piece that they can do something with?
Well, what they're talking about, I mean, usually, you know, when one just reads, they put in the in a gene for, you know, let's take the Roundup Ready that we were just talking about. That's a gene that's a, for a particular protein that then allows the plant to be resistant to the herbicide. That when one speaks then of that protein gene, but that's not all that goes into the plant. There's there's always a group of genes, or you know, a cassette. It's often called a genetic cassette of different DNAs of different sources that then are put into the organism. And those, the reason for that is because you need then a DNA that will help it get into the right place in the genome of the host organism. It's then DNA that will help turn on the gene, DNA that helps turn it off, and then you have the vector DNA or the vector organism, or if it's a you know, bacterial genes or viral genes, so the vector that helps you get it into the place, into the organism itself, and then into the place within the genome. And so you usually have, you know, well, and then there's one other in plants, which is important. Then you have the marker, so that people, that the researchers can distinguish what has gotten in, whether it's gotten in or not. And those are usually antibiotic resistance genes. So you're talking about, you know, genes of at least four to five types, depending, that are hooked together biochemically, so to speak, and then that, as a totality, is put into the organism or shot into the organism, and then one doesn't know. That's what one doesn't know, whether that's going to be cut up. It should stay the same. That's what one would like. One would like to stay the same and stay together, and incorporate into a place in the DNA strand of DNA that's already existent. Of course, then the DNA has to make room for it. Well, what happens to that space? Sometimes other genes then get turned off, or a gene gets broken in half where it's been inserted. So that these are where these unintended consequences come from, because one's never sure exactly what's going on there. And, for example, I just read in the New York Times yesterday that the Roundup Ready soybeans that some scientists have discovered there's a sequence of DNA in there that isn't in conventional soybeans. And the question is, well, where did it come from? Is it a mixed up sequence coming from the own organism, or where does it come from? But they don't know. And that, after, you know, now that's it's been 5 years since it's been on the market, I think. And now one discovered there's a little bit of DNA in there that one doesn't know what it is. So that's where there is a lot that one just doesn't know. One's manipulating into a high grade complexity with a quite primitive methods, if you will, and therefore what I always say is we should expect the unexpected.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, let's go to next line number 3 in Urbana. Hello.
Yeah, and you're very good about explaining all that. I kind of lose my train of thought just having to listen so carefully.
Sorry about that.
That's all right. I guess I got two questions. One is, I don't know whether you get into economics or not, but Danella Meadows, who's from the Sustainability Institute,
yes,
quoted C.S. Lewis, one sentence. It's what we call man's power over nature turns out to be a power exercised by some men over other men with nature as its instrument.
That's quite a fitting quote, if you ask me.
Yeah, and I was kind of wondering if you'd explore the economic meaning of what's going on a bit. And then I was wondering if, what's the state of knowledge as to the transference of things like insect resistance to the weed population And I guess that could be looked at from an economic point of view, too, but either one of those.
Right. Yeah, well, from the economic perspective, I mean, that's a huge question, and one can look at it from various sides. But on the one hand, one can say that economics are what are driving this. I mean, it's the companies who make incredibly large investments in research to make a new product like the Roundup Ready or the BT corn or whatever it may be, and Monsanto came up with this idea of the Roundup Ready as a if you're thinking in terms of the economics of a particular company, then that was a great idea. They have Roundup herbicide, but now to have plants that are resistant to that, so that this can be used even more, and the sales of Roundup have, of course, skyrocketed, so that they're not only making money through the fees that one has to pay to buy the seeds and use the seeds, but also because the farmers are using then more of the Roundup. It's a very ingenious strategy to, you know, make more money for the company. Whether it's an ingenious strategy for farming and for the health of our ecosystems and our overall economy, that in the long term, that's a whole another question. But the research is largely economic driven, and that's why it's very hard to feel like there's much in objectivity or where to find objectivity. It's very hard because a lot of the, as I said before, the government, the industry, and then the universities are all, you know, holding hands basically, and there used to be more distinctions, I think, than there are now. So it's very hard to know what you're dealing with in the way when you're getting information on these things. That's the one thing. I'd just like to mention something that I read recently in a scientific journal, that the use of BT corn is a corn that then makes its own pesticide, insecticide, and the interesting thing about that is that the farmers before they were using this did not spray very much of the pesticides against this particular pest, which is the European corn borer. It's the larva of a moth, and they were not using much pesticide. Now the pesticide or insecticide is built into the plant, and on about 20 to 30 or 40% of all the corn, and so that you have pesticides going into the plants, into the environment, in much greater amounts than they were before. This pest, one did not spray nearly as much before as one does now. One doesn't spray, one has the plants that do it, so that one's actually doing something that you could justifiably call overkill, right? What's the reason for that? Do we need that? Evidently not, but somebody needs it, the companies who produce the products. And that's where you can see this egotism driven market aspect of the market economy is a real problem. It's a real problem in this.
We have less than 10 minutes in this part of Focus, and again, I hope the caller forgive me for going on because we have some other folks here. Let me introduce once again our guest. We're speaking with Craig Holdridge. He is a director of the Nature Institute. He was involved in founding this in 1998. He's biologist and educator. The Institute is located in Ghent, New York. They do have a website if you're interested in looking at that and more information about their issues and how they approach them, some papers that he and other people have written at natureinstitute.org on the web. Up next, we have a caller in Aurora. This will be line 4. Hello.
Yes, thanks again for WILL bringing a program like this. It's just really a needful program and a fascinating. I too wanted to know about the economics of this because that's the root of most of this. But the other thing I wanted to ask was, where does the FDA stand in this?
Well, I mean, it's very complicated with the regulatory agencies. You have the USDA, the Department of Agriculture. You have the EPA, right, for the Environmental Protection Agency, and then you have the FDA. And the FDA has basically said that genetically engineered foods are substantially equivalent to other, you know, foods, and therefore do not need to be regulated. And they are already safe. And so there has been astoundingly little testing, and this is what I was saying before, is some of the companies, they did their own testing because they knew they'd better do it, otherwise it might blow up in their face because they don't want to have a product that gets recalled, you know, or something like that. It would be horrible publicity. So that the companies end up doing that research in a fairly deregulated environment. And so that there is... I mean, you will hear the regulars say it's safe, it's safe, it's safe. If you look into the details, there has been almost no testing done on it. I mean, there's been some testing done on rats and this and that. There has been testing. I won't say there hasn't been any at all, but it's not from the FDA. The research comes from the companies.
Thank you.
All right, thanks. I guess let's stay with this for a second because, again, it's going to be a point of controversy because I think that some people who would be more supportive of the technology would take issue with what you said, would say that, in fact, the safety of these products has been tested. There have been and studies show that, for example, if you feed this corn and soybeans to animals, that they do just fine. You can't tell any difference between them and animals fed on non-GM corn and soybeans.
Right.
And it's that as far as humans are concerned, that we don't have any reason to think that they're any problem. If they're in so many products now, you'd think if there was going to be a problem, we would have noticed it. And even in the case of Starlink, there was a lot of controversy about Starlink because it wasn't supposed to be in food that people were going to eat and that it did get in there.
Right.
And I think even now, from what I understand, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, that a test has been done and they found that even Starlink, there's no problem if people eat, you know, taco shells that have Starlink corn in them. That we have, there's nothing so far that would lead us to believe that that anybody's going to get sick because they're eating this stuff.
Well, I mean, you know, that's any judgment one makes in this regard is loaded. I mean, I think one just honestly has to say that it depends on what studies you take, whether you say two studies on rats and this and that are evidence enough for me to say, right, that something is safe or not. What is regarded as safe? And so I agree. It's a difficult question, and I will not pass judgment on it and say that these things are definitely not safe. It's just looking into the way it's been handled, almost more in a regulatory way. It's not been handled in a professional manner in as much as the companies have been driving the procedure, and not a third party who's looking at it critically from the outside. Of course, now that things have been looked at, I'm not going to say that USDA and the FDA have done nothing, but there was also research that was basically suppressed within the FDA where people were very critical within the FDA saying this should be tested more when they came out with the non-testing decree. And so there, it was clearly what Glickman was saying, you know, serving that the industry is what the regulatory agencies were doing. So that there, I think there is just an objective problem of looking at the things carefully. The question of safety is I would still say, open. And I think also a lot of the critique of genetic engineering does not only come from, will this give me an allergy or will this disturb this or that? It is a reaction against the whole question, or in relation to the whole question of what kind of an agriculture do we want? What kind of a relation to our products do we want? Do we want products that we can freely choose, or do we want the government telling us what is healthy and safe for us? And healthy is different from safe. I mean, that's a distinction I like to make, that when safe is one thing, healthy, is it something that's going to be really nourishing? And you can imagine how controversial that theme is and how many perspectives there are in that. And then the question of even the most broad context, what kind of agriculture is it? What kind of economic context for also including the farmers, I think of the first caller, that is healthy for them? Because they are really in a squeeze, and I wouldn't agree with the caller that that biotech agriculture is the way to do it, and that maybe one has to see that by coming back to other forms of crop rotation, perhaps smaller fields, more diversity. There have been interesting experiments, large field experiments done in the last few years that show you can get you can reduce the amount of pesticides and herbicides used a lot by knowing what kind of crops to grow with each other and integrated pest management. There's been a lot of work done there, but it's remained small because the money's been put somewhere else.
We only have about 2 minutes, and I have three callers, and I'm sorry I can't get them all. We're going to try to do just a little bit of one. We'll go to Champagne here, line two. You'll have to be brief, but please go ahead.
Okay. Well, I wanted to talk about the question of risk. Everyone keeps talking, well, there's a lot of risk with genetic manipulation. However, what about the risk of not using it? I mean, we're going to have to feed a large population. The population's going to double, is it 2025? And what if we don't have the tools to deal with that?
Yeah.
And what if somebody says, well, there are risks in this technology, so we should stop it.
Right.
Unfortunately.
I mean, it seems like it's quite a tool, and it's quite powerful. I agree that, yes, we need to regulate it, we need to look at it, but we certainly can't deny the potentials about it.
I can give you about 30 seconds, Mr. Holdridge, to
Well,
make
I'd
some
just
comment.
Like to say, I think there's an awful lot of hype in this that genetic engineering will feed the world. If you have access to the Internet, if you could look under, you could look at our website, but also the website netfuture.org, and the Net Future issue number 108. My colleague and I have written an article on the theme of golden rice, which is supposed to feed and save the hungering in Asia. And I've looked into that in great detail, and it turns out to be a very problematic and questionable solution to a very complex problem. And
I'm really sorry we're going to have to stop because we're at the end of the time, and I'm sure we could continue, but we'll have to stop with the promise that I'm certain, again, on other shows and other days, we'll continue to talk about this. But for the moment, we want to say, Mr. Holdridge, thanks very much.
Well, thank you for having me.
Our guest, Craig Holdridge, is director of the Nature Institute in Ghent, New York. And again, they do have a website with information about what they do, their perspectives on this issue at natureinstitute.org, so you can check that out.